The Jewish Heritage Foundation presents The Epic of the Eternal People, an in-depth study of Jewish history based on original source material given by Rav Shmuel Irons, Rosh HaKollel, Dean of the Kollel Institute of Greater Detroit, one of the leading centers of Talmudic research and community education in North America.
This lecture, titled Baghdad, the Capital of the Jewish and Arab World, is dedicated to the memory and the Ilui Nishmas, Rav Moshe ben Zev Wolf, Olav HaShalom, Mr. Marvin Berlin of blessed memory. There was a time when the largest, the most powerful empire on earth was ruled by Arabs. The official language of that empire was Arabic, and its official religion was Islam. The original capital of that empire was Medina, the city that welcomed Muhammad and his followers after they fled from Mecca in the year 622. After a short period in Kufa, Iraq, the next capital was located in Damascus, arguably the oldest continuously settled city in the world. During that period, the Great Mosque of Damascus, the fourth holiest site in Islam, was built by one of the early caliphs, the Arab emperor Al-Walid, and still stands to this day. In the year 762, the caliph Al-Mansur decided to build himself a new capital on the west bank of the Tigris River. In the words of Al-Mansur, quote, "It is an excellent military camp. Besides, here is the Tigris to put us in touch with the lands as far as China, and bring us all the sea's yield, as well as the food products of Mesopotamia, Armenia, and their environs. Then there's the Euphrates, to carry for us all that Syria, Al-Raqqa, the adjacent lands have to offer," end quote. The new capital was built in 4 years. 100,000 laborers, craftsmen, and architects were involved in its construction. The name of that city that Mansur built is Baghdad. The story of Baghdad, the empire which it served, and its influence on Jewish history is the topic of tonight's lecture. By the time Muhammad died in 632, all of the Arabian Peninsula was under his domination. His death came suddenly. He had no time to appoint a successor. Since no successor had been named by Muhammad, there was wide disagreement amongst his followers. The emigrants, those who fled Mecca with Muhammad and were of Muhammad's tribe, felt that the successor should be named from within their ranks. Those from Medina, who had given Muhammad and his followers sanctuary at his darkest hour, felt that they be chosen. Another group felt that the most fit person for the position was Muhammad's paternal cousin, Ali ibn Abul Talib, the husband of Muhammad's daughter Fatima, and one of the original two or three of his believers. And finally, the noblest clan of the Meccan tribe of Quraysh, the Umayyads, felt that someone from their ranks should be chosen. Although they were originally Muhammad's opponents, and the last of those to profess Islam, they had traditionally held the reins of power in Mecca, authority and wealth, and wished to continue. As we shall see, the question of succession is something that directly affects Islam and indirectly affects Israel to this day. The first party, the party of the emigrants, triumphed. Muhammad's loyal follower Abu Bakr was chosen to be the caliph or successor to Muhammad. He came with special qualifications for the position. He was one of the first three or four who believed in Muhammad. He was the father of Muhammad's third and favorite wife, Aisha, and he was a man respected for his age and piety. As soon as he was appointed, Abu Bakr was immediately faced with a crisis. The various tribes that occupied the Arabian Peninsula outside Hejaz, the immediate area of Mecca, Medina, rebelled. From his capital in Medina, Abu Bakr sent his most able general, Khalid ibn Walid. In a series of short but sharp battles, the Muslims prevailed, and Arabia was once again united under Muslim rule. Aglow with victory, Abu Bakr now began his campaign for the conquest of Syria and Palestine. In the midst of his first victories in August of 634, after only ruling for some 2 years, Abu Bakr died. Before his death, he named as his successor Umar ibn al-Khattab, an earlier follower of Muhammad and the father of one of Muhammad's other wives. Umar continued the northward campaign with stunning results. After the Muslim conquest of Damascus, Heraclius, the Byzantine emperor, sent an army of 50,000 troops to defeat Umar and his forces. They met at the Yarmouk River Valley in what is today Jordan. Umar's general, Khalid ibn Walid, confronted them with half that number in a hot, windy, and dusty day on August 20th, 636. Despite the chants and prayers of the Byzantine priests in the presence of their crosses, or maybe because of them, the army of Heraclius was thoroughly routed. From there, the Arabs proceeded to capture all of Palestine and Syria up until the Taurus Mountains. So that's the natural boundary between Syria and Turkey. The next to fall was the Sassanid Empire of the Persians. In 637, the Arab army entered Ctesiphon, the Persian capital, without even a fight. The Persian king, Yezdegerd, having fled eastward in panic with his family and troops. We mentioned this victory, by the way, in a previous lecture in the story of Bustanai. In 639, another brilliant Arab general, Amir ibn al-As, launched a campaign against Egypt's leading port and capital, Alexandria. At the time, Alexandria was the seat of the Byzantine navy and had a garrison of some 50,000 troops. Without a single ship, without siege machines, and with only a force of some 20,000 troops, Amir began his campaign. A year later, he wrote the following words to the Caliph Umar, quote, "I have captured a city from the description of which I shall refrain. Suffice it to say that I have seized therein 4,000 villas with 4,000 baths, 40,000 poll tax paying Jews." They looked Jews as a real asset, and 400 places of entertainment for the royalty. The site on which Amir pitched his camp became the new capital, Al-Fustat, near the present modern city of Cairo. After the fall of Egypt, Amir pushed westward the head of his cavalry. He reached as far as Tripoli in what is today Libya. On the eastern front, by the year 641, the Persian armies were totally defeated. Even though they had given up the capital, they had fallen back. But they were still a fighting force to contend with. Finally, in 641, they were totally defeated. And by the year 643, Arab armies had reached the borders of India. Umar's reign over this vast empire, however, was short-lived. In November 644, the Caliph Umar was assassinated by a Persian slave. Assassination, as we're going to see, became commonplace in Islam. His successor was Uthman, a son-in-law of Muhammad and a member of the powerful Umayyad clan. Remember, the Umayyads were one of the groups that claimed originally that they should take over the leadership. And now they had that opportunity. In his reign, the Quran was written down and took its final form. And in terms of Islam history, the reign of Uthman is extremely important. Because of his increasing weakness due to old age and his preference to appoint members of his own tribe, the Quraysh, and they were appointed to virtually all responsible positions of power, there was tremendous ill feelings that were created by those who were disenfranchised. Disorders broke out in Egypt and Iraq, which culminated with his assassination by the son of Abu Bakr in 656. So he reigned for 12 years. Ali, Muhammad's son-in-law, was then elected caliph. As we said before, originally, 24 years before, when Muhammad died, he was a candidate. Now he had his opportunity. There was, though, much opposition to his appointment. first by a group led by Muhammad's widow Aisha, the daughter of Abu Bakr, and then by Muawiyah, Uthman's cousin, who was governor of Syria and was the leader of the Umayyad clan. After a reign which was troubled with much dissension and rebellion, in the year 661, after only 5 years, Ali was finally assassinated by a fanatical former supporter. Muawiyah declared himself caliph and marched on Iraq, which he soon got under his control. Ali's son Hassan, who upon his father's death had declared himself caliph, in the face of an invasion by Muawiyah and discord among his own troops, abdicated a few months later and retired to Medina. The victory of Muawiyah opened a new chapter in Islamic history. I just like to just to go over, because we mentioned a lot of names, and it's worthwhile. In the back of the handout, we have a timetable. So just the beginning of that timetable, just again to give you a sense of what's happening here. 622 is the beginning of the Muslim calendar. This is when Muhammad and his followers fled to Medina. This is the Hijra. In 632, 10 years later, Muhammad died and was succeeded by Abu Bakr. 634, 2 years later, Abu Bakr was succeeded by Umar. 644, 10 years after that, Umar is succeeded by Uthman. 656, 12 years after that, Uthman is succeeded by Ali, Muhammad's son-in-law. And 661, Ali is assassinated. And again, the rift amongst Muslims regarding succession. Unlike the first four elected successors of Muhammad, we had Abu Bakr, Umar, Uthman, and Ali, they were all elected by the elders. Muawiyah was the first that seized the caliphate by force, a dangerous precedent. Not everyone supported Muawiyah. A sizable minority felt the position of caliph, the successor of Muhammad, the leader of the believers of Islam, should have rightfully belonged to Ali, Muhammad's son-in-law, and to Ali's descendants, Muhammad's grandchildren, as they felt it should go with Yihus, as it should be a dynastic rule, but beginning with Muhammad and continuing on with Muhammad's family. The party of Ali was called Shiite Ali, or Shiites for short. The Shiites did not recognize Muawiyah and supported the claim of Hassan, who was forced from office by Muawiyah, as we explained, and who died mysteriously in 669, even though probably the Shiites have some theory of who killed him, and the subsequent claim of Ali's other son, Hussein. Hussein was killed by Umayyad troops at Karbala, Iraq, in the year 680, as he was attempting to reclaim his position as caliph after the death of Muawiyah. Most of his family and followers died with him. To this day, Karbala is a major pilgrimage site for Shiites. Today, there are actually three groups of Shiites. The majority of Shiites are Ithna Ashariya. It's like Shnei Moser, 12ers. Ashariya is like 10 in Arabic. These are 12ers, which means they recognize 12 imams, or leaders of Islam, who were descended from Ali, besides the original four caliphs, Abu Bakr, Umar, Uthman, and Ali. The last one of the 12 is supposed to have disappeared without a trace. According to Shiite legend, he never died, but returned one day as the Mahdi, the Muslim or Shiach, to redeem the faithful. This idea of the leader not dying seems to crop up throughout history. These 12ers make up 60% of all Shiites and make up the majority of the Muslims in Iran and Iraq. The Ayatollah Khomeini of Iran was a 12er. There is yet a group of Shiites called Zaydites, like Zaydi, or Fivers. They believe in only 5 descendants of Ali. They represent the Muslims in the northern mountain area of Yemen. Another group of Shiites are the Seveners, or Ismailites. Their group lives today in Pakistan and India. An interesting offshoot of the Ismailites were the Assassins, a fanatical group of Ismailites in Persia and Syria who flourished from the 11th to the 13th centuries. They're really destroyed by the Mongols. The terror they wrought amongst Orthodox Muslims and Crusaders, and their killing of prominent individuals, especially under the influence of hashish, earned them a name that survives today. Hashish created the name Hashashan, one who is under the influence of hashish, or assassin. So the word assassin comes from this group who were under the influence of hashish. All these groups were vying for, of course, for power throughout the Middle Ages, the various Shiite groups. Those who actually were well entrenched in power, though, the majority of Muslims, however, supported Muawiyah. These were called Sunnites, or more properly, the Al-Sunna wal-Jama'ah. The people of the Sunnah. Sunna means the practices of Muhammad, like the Maisim. Wal-Jama is and Ve'al. Wa'al is like Ve'al. Jama is the community, like the Amma, like the Ummah. Note the emphasis on the community. This is the Sunnites, the majority. For the Sunnites, it does not suffice to follow the Sunnah, the practice of Muhammad, as reflected in the Quran and the Hadith, the oral tradition of Muhammad's teaching, but also the ijma, the practices of the consensus of the Muslim community. It is basic to their beliefs that Allah's hand is constantly with the Muslim community to protect them from error. Thus, if the majority of the community chooses a certain path, it must be right. And therefore, since the majority of believers forsook the descendants of Muhammad and accepted Muawiyah, it must have been Allah's will. Understandably, the Shiites do not believe in this principle. They place infallibility rather with the Imam, the successor and descendant of Muhammad, who according to the Shiites was blessed with prophetic powers and infallible understanding. This short discourse on the origin of the majority Sunnites and the minority Shiites is not only important from a historical perspective, but also gives us greater insight into current events. The Ayatollah Khomeini, together with the rest of the Iranians, his Ayatollahs, and the Hezbollah in Lebanon, are all Shiites. Saddam Hussein, Hosni Mubarak, the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt, and the Hamas in Palestine are all Sunnites. Let us now return to Muawiyah's successful rise to power after the assassination of Ali. As soon as Muawiyah came to power, he moved his capital to Damascus and founded a dynasty, the Umayyads, that lasted for almost 90 years. It was the time of the blossoming of Arabic architecture. In the year 691, under the Caliph Abd el-Malik, you know, Abd is like the Evid of the Melech. Evid shel Melech is Abd el-Malik. The Mosque of Umar on the Temple Mount was built. The Mosque of Umar was not built by Umar, or the Mosque of Omar, as it said. It was built by Abd el-Malik. Umar was the one who conquered Jerusalem. But he did not build that mosque. His successor, Al-Walid, who next to Umar was the most brilliant of the caliphs, because after all, Umar was the one who created the Arabic Empire, as we said. It was under his direction that Palestine, Syria, Persia, Egypt, Libya, India, you know, this up until India was captured. El-Walid, under his rule, Spain, all of northern Africa, and Spain was captured. In his reign, the great mosque of Damascus was built, and El-Walid enlarged and beautified the Al-Aqsa Mosque in Jerusalem and Muhammad's Mosque in Medina. He, more than any of his predecessors, was responsible for having created an infrastructure within the empire. New canals were constructed, marshes drained, roads were cared for, wells dug, fields plowed. The Umayyad reign saw a revival of Arabic poetry and the conversion of a vast majority of the populace to Islam, and for the most part the acceptance of the Arabic tongue as their language. The image of the caliph also went through a metamorphosis. Abu Bakr and Umar, the first caliphs, lived simple and frugal lives. Umar is said to have owned but one shirt and one cloak, which were all full of patches. He slept on a bed of palm leaves. The Umayyads, of course, by contrast, were real kings. Muawiyah built himself a glittering palace in Damascus. The great mosque of Damascus, built by Ibn Walid, still today one of the most impressive structures on earth, was where the Umayyad caliphs formally received dignitaries. The simple Arabs of Mecca and Yemen had swallowed and absorbed a more culturally advanced civilization and became its beneficiaries. But true secular cultural scholarship and the depravity and decadence that came in its wake were yet to come. The Umayyad period was also a time of major discontent. First, there were the Shiites, the followers of the family of Ali, who, as we've just said, claimed that only Ali and his descendants have the right to become caliph. Then there were the Kharijites, a group of fanatical dissidents who claimed that the only true qualification for the position of caliph was piety and saintliness. They turned against Ali when they viewed his attempts to politically come to terms with Muawiyah as a compromise of pure Islamic principles. One of their group eventually assassinated Ali. The Kharijites, like the Shiites, did not recognize the authority of the Umayyad Caliphate. Unrest came from other sources as well. The Mawali, the converted Muslims from the vast lands that the Arabs had conquered, were unhappy with their treatment as second-class citizens. The tribes themselves of the conquerors were afforded land, were afforded a place. The Mawali were really considered attached, like second class, to the conquerors. Though they were not humiliated like the Jews or the Christians, they were still denied the full privileges that were afforded the Arab conquerors. In addition, within the Arab ranks, there was the ancient tensions between the Kays, the northern Arabs, the descendants of Yishmael, and Yamans, which we've discussed in the previous lecture, and the Yamans, the southern Arabs, the descendants of Yoktan. Now, as we look, we call them all Arabs, but there's really a big difference. And the southern Arabs looked at themselves much differently than, they looked at themselves as the original Arabs. And the northern Arabs looked at them, which even according to Arabic history, they came in later on the stage of history. But they, of course, looked at themselves as descendants of Yishmael. So they looked at themselves that they had a special yichus. They had special claims. Taking advantage of this great general turmoil, says Abu el Abbas, a descendant of Muhammad's uncle Al-Abbas, and the head of a quasi-messianic movement, declared himself to be Al-Safa, literally the bloodshedder. Safa is like Saif in Hebrew, of the knife. The precursor of the Mahdi. In other words, he was supposed to come, this, at least according to their belief, this Al-Safa was supposed to pave the way for the Al-Mahdi, the Mashiach, the Arabic version of Messiah, to come. With the support of an army based in Khorasan, which is eastern Iran, bordering Iran and Afghanistan, Abu al-Abbas toppled the last Umayyad caliph, Marwan, and began a dynasty, the Abbasids, meaning the descendants of al-Abbas, Muhammad's uncle. So they wanted to somehow create a certain legitimacy for themselves, claiming this descent from semi-royalty. And this dynasty lasted in some form for almost 800 years. They didn't maintain power, as we're going to explain, during that whole time. But there were at least descendants who claimed at least honors because they were part of that family. After assuming power, Abul Abbas, true to his title Al-Safa, the bloodshedder, saw to it that every remaining member of the Umayyad family should be hunted down and exterminated. One Abbasid general invited 80 leading members of the deposed house to a banquet. In the course of the feast, he had them all cut down, and after spreading leather covers over the dead and dying, continued his meal. It gives you an indication of what kind of people we're dealing with. One of the descendants of the Umayyad house, who was saved, Abd al-Rahman, managed to escape his pursuers, and after making his way to Spain, became Spain's ruler. Most of the Umayyad dynasty were not so lucky. It was under the Abbasids that Islamic civilization experienced its golden age. After Abul Abbas's death in 754, Mansur, his brother, became caliph. Having been supported by the army of Khorasan, East Iran, against his many rivals, including his uncle Abdullah, the governor of Syria, Mansur felt it was prudent to build a capital closer to his base of power in Khorasan and further away from his enemies in Syria and Arabia. The site that he chose was Baghdad, as we explained in the beginning of the lecture, an old market town located in the Tigris River. Maybe it's just worthwhile at this point to look now at the handout. Baghdad has a long history. According to Rashi, one of the early Amoraim, the early teachers of the Talmud, who was a disciple of Shmuel, a colleague of Rav Yehuda, was Rav Chona Bagdasar, according to Rashi, of Baghdad. The city of Baghdad is described as a place in history that when the Arabs originally began their conquest of the Persian Empire, one of their major moves was to attack Baghdad. It was a market town, and as we'll look in there in Baghdad was a great fair which attracted merchants and wealthy buyers. And of course, the Arab cavalry took everyone by surprise. This was the year 634, shortly after. This was the beginning of the conquest. 3 years later, this is Yezdegerd, fled the capital. It was in total retreat. And Iraq fell into the hands totally of the Arabs. But Baghdad was even then a major area. We know that it was also a major Jewish area. There's not only do we have Rav Chona Bagdasar, but in the Gaonic period, we have one of the Gaonim who ruled in the year 748. This is some years before Mansur built up Baghdad, who came from that area. And we have one of the other Gaonim of Pumpadisa, who in the year 796 became Gaon, and they became Gaon already in their 70s and 80s, when they were quite well in years. You know, he had also been born in that general vicinity. What Mansur did was took an area which had been a minor provincial city and made it into a major cosmopolitan area and the capital of his empire. By the year 766, he had converted it into an architectural marvel. The city was circular in form. It had double brick walls with a deep moat, and a third innermost wall rising 90 feet surrounding the central area. He wanted to make sure it was well defended. The walls had four gates from which four highways, starting from the center of the circle, radiated like the spokes of a wheel to the four corners of the empire. Those were the beginnings of four major highways. At the very center of the city, the caliph built himself a magnificent palace. The dome of the audience chamber of that palace rose to a height of 130 feet. By comparison, the Dome of the Rock, one of the most magnificent Umayyad structures, only rises 96 feet from ground level. The audience chamber was bedecked with rugs, curtains, and cushions, the best that the Orient could produce. Next to the palace was the Great Mosque of Baghdad. The new capital soon also became the commercial intellectual center of the Islamic Empire. And because of its proximity to Persia, the caliphate took on a different face. Gradually, Persian titles, Persian wines, despite the fact that wine is forbidden by Islam, Persian songs, Persian wives and mistresses, and Persian ideas and thoughts became integrated into life, the descendants of the Arabian Peninsula. Under Harun al-Rashid, who reigned between 786 and 809, the city had no peer throughout the world. The empire, after over 150 years of conquest, was already flooded with slaves. The practice of castration of slaves, thereby making them eunuchs, was one of the institutions which was imported from Persia. The whole Purim story, the Sorisim, as most explained, these were eunuchs. Of course, by the fact is now they no longer had any desire, any sexual desire, made them basically, the king had much more confidence that they couldn't be swayed by any influence, and therefore they were considered much more loyal. This in turn allowed for the creation of the harem. Because for a harem, you need security forces. You have to make sure no one slips in. And you have to make sure that the security forces are physically have the power, and as it can't be women, but yet don't have desire themselves for the ladies of the harem. And therefore, says they created all these eunuchs. Under Harun, it grew to such proportion that the palace, with its many annexes for harems, eunuchs, and functionaries, occupied a full third of the central city. And it dripped with luxury. Zubaydah, Harun's cousin and wife, saw to it that all of the vessels of the royal table were made of gold or silver and studded with gems. Harun al-Rashid was also a connoisseur of the arts. Poets, wits, musicians, singers, dancers, trainers of fighting dogs and cocks descended on the capital. It became the entertainment capital of the world. Those men and women of special artistic talent who won the favor of the caliph assured for themselves lasting wealth and fame. Into the bazaars of the city came porcelain, silk, and musk from China, spices, minerals, and dyes from India and Malaya, rubies, lapis lazuli, fabrics and Turkish slaves from Central Asia, honey, wax, furs, and white slaves from Scandinavia and Russia, ivory, gold dust, black slaves from Eastern Africa, rice, grain, linen from Egypt, glass, metalware, and fruits from Syria, brocade, pearls, and weapons from Arabia, silks, perfumes, and vegetables from Persia. The fairy tale-like reign of Harun al-Rashid has been captured for all eternity in Alf Layla wa Layla, 1001 Arabian Nights. It's a description of Harun al-Rashid's reign. Under his immediate successors, the splendor continued to grow. In 917, the Byzantine Emperor Constantine VII sent envoys to Baghdad to arrange the exchange and ransom of prisoners. The Caliph al-Muqtadir arranged a royal reception. The parade included 160,000 cavalry and footmen. I mean, he wanted to impress these people. 7,000 black and white eunuchs, 700 chamberlains, and 100 lions. In the caliph's palace hung 38,000 curtains, of which 12,500 were gilded, plus 22,000 rugs. Imagine if New York Harper were around then. The envoys were so struck with awe and admiration at the opulence that they first mistook the chamberlain's office and then the vizier's office for the royal audience chamber. Notice, evidently, what these minor officials had was much greater than even the Byzantine emperor had. The envoys were especially impressed with the Hall of the Tree. It was named for the official tree of gold and silver. I mean, we know all of this because they wrote up what they saw. An account has been made. That occupied the hall. It weighed 500,000 drams, approximately a ton. On the branches, mechanical singing birds were attached. They also were made of gold and silver. The envoys were also impressed at the artificially dwarf palm trees in the royal garden, like the bonsai trees that the Japanese made. They made miniature palm trees. The skilled cultivation of the royal gardeners had yielded superb dates of rare varieties. But all of this magnificence hid a growing rot that was eventually to destroy the empire. Alongside the harems and eunuchs, there developed the institution of the gehilman, the often castrated male prostitute. These were the recipients of special favors from their masters. They wore rich, attractive uniforms, and they often beautified and perfumed their bodies in an effeminate fashion. After the death of Harun, Al-Amin, Harun's son and successor, made the institution fashionable. Many of the poems were written in the period praising this practice. The unlimited concubines and numberless half-brothers and half-sisters in the imperial household, with their unavoidable jealousies and intrigues, undermined the strength and vitality of the royal household. The luxurious living, with its emphasis on wine and song, sapped their vigor and moral fiber. It was also a period of great class distinction. There were, of course, the Arab aristocracy associated with the caliph, his family, and his government. Then there was the middle class, composed of writers, scholars, artists, merchants, craftsmen, and professionals. The majority of the people, though, were lower class, farmers, herdsmen, and country folk who represented the native population. We have to realize, before the Arab came, there were all this whole native population. By and large, even after the conquest, they were converted to Islam, but they kept to themselves, and because they were not of the ruling race, so to speak, they weren't considered like Jews or Christians, but they were considered like semi-dehimis, in other words, second-class citizens. And they became increasingly poorer. The imposition of taxes for the rich, the benefit of the ruling class, discouraged farming and industries, and as, you know, like the song, the rich get richer and the poor get poorer, that's what happened to the vast majority of those who lived in the Arabic Empire. And all of this, of course, created terrible tension, and it created revolts, at least attempted revolts, which had to be constantly suppressed. So, there was, again, the poor against the rich, the southern Arabs against the northern Arabs, the Syrian Arabs against the Iraqi Arabs. There were wars of succession, as after the old caliph died, who was to be the successor. In the turmoil and dissatisfaction, fanatical sects of Shiites found numerous followings amongst the mistreated and disenfranchised, and they rose up with a vengeance against their Sunni masters. As a result, the caliph had to resort to using more and more non-Arab troops to quell these rebellions, and the generals of these troops increasingly became a power unto themselves. By the middle of the 10th century, Baghdad had become a mere provincial capital, with the caliphs a mere figurehead, The true power was first held by a dynasty of Shiite Persians who control the army. They were loyal to the king, but they controlled the army. Ultimately, they were the power. And from the middle of the 11th century, by the Seljuk Turks. They were Sunnites, but they were Turks. The end came in the year 1258, when the Mongols' hordes finally reached Baghdad. After killing the majority of its citizens, the Mongols thoroughly plundered the cities and put much of it to the torch. The last caliph of Baghdad, al-Mustasim, together with his family and entourage, were put to death by the Mongols' leader, Hulagu, a grandson of Genghis Khan. The story is that they were wrapped in carpets and trampled to death. Those who were left living, interestingly enough, were the Christians. The Nestorian Christians were afforded special treatment because Hulagu's mother was a Nestorian Christian. We discussed, again, in a previous lecture, in the Byzantine Empire, we discussed the various sects of the Christians. And the Nestorians today were a very small group, but actually then were a very large. They were not the Orthodox, the Catholic, but they were then a very large and prominent group. The city was eventually rebuilt, but nothing remained today of the glorious city that was built by the House of Abbasid. A few years after the destruction of Baghdad, the Egyptian Sultan Baybars installed a descendant of the Abbasid house with the honorary title Caliph. But he had no power. The last of that line died in the year 1538 in Cairo. But the city of Baghdad is not only associated with the Arabs. Probably the first mention of the name, as we said, as we find, is named in the Talmud. The city of Baghdad, after it was built and became the capital of the empire, became also a center of Jewish power. Throughout all the years of the Reish Galusa, we find him amongst the Jews, in Nahar Dor, in Sura, in the Jewish areas near the centers of Torah learning. Already by the year, as we find, says, in the 9th century, in the year 820, we find the Reish Galusa already in Baghdad. He had moved. Perhaps it's indicative of the importance that he felt that he be near the nexus of power. It's perhaps indicative of the changing demographics of the Jews. Jews originally were farmers in Babylon. By and large, it seems to have been the major form of income for Jews was farming. Because of the heavy taxes, because of the many wars, we find a change. Jews no longer were farmers, and it's quite possible now they were forced, as was we know in recent history, to move to the big city. Once you don't have the farm, the place to move is the big city. You know, it's really the Willie Sutton principle. They asked Willie Sutton, the famous bank robber, why he robs banks. And his answer was, because that's where the money is. But whatever the cause, we find, it's interesting, that the Reish Galusa, we find here on page 2, in paragraph A, an incident is recorded. There was a question of succession of the Reish Galusa, and in the interim, there were two Gaonim. When they finally made peace, describing when they came together in the year 820 to Baghdad at a meeting. it was finally decided, this is the story, says that one of the Gaonim, the more recent one, gave up his position to the elder Gaon, and after eventually the elder Gaon died, he became the successor. But it happened in Baghdad. And evidently, says, the Reish Galusa had moved. But another very interesting development occurred, which had a major impact on Jewish history. The Reish Galusa, from early on, was supported by the non-Jewish government. It was first the Persians, then the Arabs. We told over the story of Bustanoi that the Arab emperor, the caliph, was well disposed to Bustanoi. That's why he gave him the Persian princess as his wife. He took one of the sisters to be a wife, and he gave the other to the Reish Galusa. And again, the position of Reish Galusa, the exilarch, the Jewish governor of the Jews, was supported by the non-Jewish government. A major change occurred, we have now in paragraph B, when they fell out of influence. The Arab government no longer recognized or supported the Reish Galusa. And as a result, without governmental support, he had to find support in other areas, because without that, he had no means of enforcing the Jewish government. And he looked to the other source of power amongst Jews, the Gaonim, the heads of the yeshivas. And they extracted a price for their support. Throughout the period, we know from Rav Shrira Gaon that there was misuse of power by the Reish Galusa. We know the story that we had mentioned in a previous lecture, that the Reish Galusa had taken the Rosh Yeshiva, had severely punished him, had put him in a dungeon and let him out at night to sleep at night, not allowing him to be allowed to in any of the homes, had torn out the hairs of his beard. This is only one incident, it seems, of a long litany of complaints of the Reish Galusa. Their power was taken away from them in 825 and was re-given to them on a different basis. Now let's read now from the letter of Rav Shrira Gaon. In the midst of the reign of the Arabs in the time of David ben Yehuda, which is around the year 825, the Nasi, the Reish Galusa, fell from power, no longer had the backing of the government. From that time on, the Rosh Yeshiva Pumpadisa would no longer go there, in other words, as a form of honor to the Reish Galusa, but rather when the Reish Galusa would want to have the assemblage in Pumpadisa, he would go there to Pumpadisa to have it set there. There was one time, there was traditionally a time where the Reish Galusa was honored, and it was an assembly, but he made sure they come to the yeshiva rather than having the whole yeshiva go to the Reish Galusa. Writing at this time, there is no one left of the house of the Nasi except for one child. We do know from other sources, of course, that it lasted after this time, but the latter period of the Gaonim, again, is going to be a subject of one of the lectures of next year's series. And let us now read from another source. This is from Rishmuel ben Ali, who was a contemporary of the Rambam, who was a Rosh Yeshiva in Baghdad in the year 1170. And he writes, in the years of David ben Yehuda, the exilarch, the members of this family were removed from the service of the kings. After they tried to join the learned men and the yeshivas were not received till they accepted the conditions which yeshiva which supported them. These conditions were confirmed in the handwriting of every succeeding exilarch. Such documents are still preserved in our archives. He does not say exactly what those conditions are. From previous lecture, though, we do know that there were taxes imposed on various areas of where the Jews lived under the dominion of the Gaonim and the Reish Galusa. Most of the areas were under the dominion of the Rosh Yeshivas.
They were the ones who appointed judges. They were the ones who collected taxes. A minor area was afforded to the Resh Galusa to support him and his entourage. So their power, in a sense, was taken away. And as we're going to see from a subsequent story, that actually that the Resh Galusa's power could be taken away as well. As we're going to... The Resh Galusa. It was taken away from the Arabs. It was granted to them by the Rosh Yeshiva. But it was no longer certain that they would always have that power. And as we're going to explain, there was a period when the Rosh Yeshiva took away the power from the Resh Galusa. You could just look at, we won't go into detail now, look in your notes on page 3 and 4. It describes still, this account seems to come after he was deposed. But he still was an intermediary, he was still the Jewish governor, he didn't have to have the same support from the Arab caliph. But still he was afforded respect both amongst Jews and non-Jews. We brought the first paragraph of this in a previous lecture, how when he came to visit the king, he rode the chariot, which was the equivalent of the other ministers of the king. A whole entourage came with him. When he would come, he would to the king's palaces, he would disperse all kinds of bribes to make sure that he was afforded the right honors, which in a sense gives you a sense. Here you could look at the bottom, page 3. Disperse bribe with gold and silver coins to the king's servants from a purse which he prepared for them in his bosom and in his chest. The amount of money he's dispersed on occasion varied as it was in accordance with the blessings of the Holy One blessed with bestowed upon him in terms of how he had collected taxes. The servants in turn honored him and took him by the hand, escorted him to the king. Evidently, had he not paid them, they would have not brought him to the king. He would then prostrate himself before the king, and the king would hint him to stand on one foot. This is very interesting what this means, while being supported with the other. This he would do until the king would hint it to one of his servants to take him by the hand and seat him in the palace he had designated for him. Like he was, evidently he had bowed, as they curtsy, so they bowed and had been on one foot and remained standing on one foot. This must have been the standard protocol. And then he would sit him by him, and they would have this discussion, and the exilarch, the Resh Galusa, would present a request, which upon this is that finally says the king would grant. So he was still the representative of the Jews, but his power now came from the people, and less from the king. But even so, we have a story again which comes approximately the year 925, 100 years after the year 825, when his power had been taken away from by the Persians, and yet when there was a problem of support, when the son of David ben Zakkai, who was the Resh Galusa then, had problems with Jews in Persia, the governmental support was used to assure that his support was reinstated, and those who had slighted him were punished. So there was no longer supported totally by the Arabic kings. The Arabic kings still honored him, but his support also had to come with the Rosh Yeshiva. This is one major historic change that occurred. There was, of course, another major historic change that occurred. Since the support of the Resh Galusa was from the Rosh Yeshivas and not totally from the caliphs, there was room for another base of power. A base of power perhaps even more powerful than the Resh Galusa. And that was from the Jewish aristocracy, the wealthy bankers of the Jewish bankers of the caliph. The caliph needed much money. We've described before the opulence of his palaces. He kept having to keep on waging wars. The money had to come from someplace. Jews, of course, pay taxes. But very often, when he was short of finances, he needed loans. Those loans came from Jews. Those Jews, therefore, became very powerful because they had the ear of the caliph and, in fact, were more powerful than the Reish Galusa himself, which is the following story is going to illustrate this on page 6. One of the Reish Galusa had the name of Ukba. An argument developed between the Rosh Yeshiva Pumpadisa and the Reish Galusa regarding the district of Khorasan. This is Afghanistan. Originally, the district of Khorasan belonged to Pumpadisa. As we explained before, that since the year 825, and it was this whole reorganization, the taxes for major areas now went to support the yeshivas. Incidentally, it was from this time on that we find the blossoming of yeshivas. The yeshivas from this time on became international centers. And they had the monies, not only, of course, from outside of Babylon, but they have monies from these districts to support these large outlays of funds which were necessary to support the scholars and residents who live now in these yeshivas. The more money, anyone who operates a yeshiva knows, the more money you have, the more opportunity you have for expansion and increasing student body and faculty. And that's what happened during this period. And of course, there's always the pressure of funding. Mar Ukva, the Reish Galusa, felt that the monies of Khorasan should come to him, and his needs come over the needs of the yeshivas. We've in this class before, I think it's worth retelling the cartoon that I saw. You know, there's a beautiful cartoon I saw some 20 years ago of Moses, Moshe Rabbeinu, on Mount Sinai, in Har Sinai. In a cartoon form, you know, something like Ziggy, in a cartoon form, Moshe Rabbeinu is in Har Sinai, he's holding the Shnei Luchos HaBris, he's holding the two tablets, it's there's clouds, there's lightning, there's fire, and Moses is looking up. And the caption reads, "But what about funding?" And this became a source of a whole dispute between the Reish Galusa and the Rosh Yeshiva. Rav Koyen Sedek, who was, according to this account, is the Rosh Yeshiva's support from Yosef ben Pinchas. Yosef ben Pinchas was the banker, as we're going to read an account at the end of this lecture here on page 7. This account, we have a letter from the caliph to Yosef ben Pinchas asking him for a loan and saying he better give it or else. So Yosef ben Pinchas' son-in-law Natira, together with some of the aristocracy of the generation, supported the Rosh Yeshiva over the Reish Galusa, and they finally had him removed. This was something which was impossible before in Jewish history. The Reish Galusa was king. And yet here, it was possible, we are witnessing a whole change in the dynamics of power. And the Gvirim, the aristocracy, now have more power than the Reish Galusa. Even though, of course, officially Reish Galusa appoints judges, he is the official representative of the Jewish community to the king, but yet the real power lies, at least a major source of power, lies amongst this Jewish aristocracy, the bankers of the caliph. The story goes on, and you could read it inside, how Ukba finally ingratiated himself to the caliph, got himself back into his position. And as I read now, you could read yourself, it's a fascinating story. But I read from the bold print in the second paragraph, Natira, which is the son-in-law of Yosef and Pinchas. Yosef and Pinchas and his group find it very difficult to tolerate the restoration of Ukbah to his former position. They prevailed upon the king to exile him once more, which is no mean feat, because the king had already granted him, had already brought him back to power, and evidently much pressure was brought to bear that the king make an about-face. We know from the story when we just had of Purim and Achashverosh, it was very hard for Achashverosh to rescind the original letters that he sent. Instead of rescinding them, he had to really write a whole new draft, a whole new group of letters, which really contradicted the first one. But he couldn't rescind them. And here, pressure was brought, and the king rescinded the appointment, and Ukbah was exiled once again. This is taken from the account of Nosna Bavli. This is one of the major historic sources of the period. We have a fragment found in the Cairo Geniza of a book describing the family history of Natira, which was Yosef ben Pinchas' son-in-law. In it, a fantastic story is told, much like the story of Purim. The vizier Ibn Abbas's Il-Baghil incited the caliph's Mutadid to sign a death warrant against all Jews in Babylon. This is the story that's written. Their decree was written but not sealed. The caliph subsequently had three dreams wherein Eliyahu HaNavi, Elijah the prophet, appeared and influenced the caliph not to implement the decree. Because only a fragment of the original work remains, many of the details are missing. But we do know that the caliph called in Natira, after all he was a banker, and proceeded to ask him many questions that have troubled him, many of which were understanding Hebrew scripture. After Natira had successfully answered the questions and put the caliph's mind at ease, the caliph destroyed the decree and threw the vizier, this is the vizier is the equivalent of Haman, the Mishnah Melech, Ibn Abbas is Il-Baghil, this is in prison where he died. Natir was offered all the wealth and slaves of the fallen vizier, but refused. He did not even accept the king's offer of exemption from taxes. The Jews enjoyed much peace and security during the rest of Caliph Mutadid's reign. And we have here, this is a quote from this, from the fragment. The caliph had offered to let all the Jews not pay taxes because there was a special tax that only Jews paid. And he said they should not, because if they ceased paying taxes, this tax was a jizya, which was a which they paid for protection. And he felt, says, because by the payment of jizya, the Jews became dehimis. Dehimis we understand to be second-class citizens. The real word means is protected subjects. Maybe they were protected against riots. They would be protected against other things. That if they were beginning to equal citizens, they would lose that protection. So, were the tax to be abolished, Jewish blood would be shed freely. And because of this, this is not Tira's appeal, which we've quoted in a previous lecture, the Jews continued to pay the poll tax. We find the influence at a later date during the reign of, we said, David ben Zakkai, which was quoted before, and we call the story that David ben Zakkai's son went to Persia and was mistreated and had to ask help from the caliph. When the Gaon of Sura, Rav Sadia Gaon, which will be a subject of a lecture next year, was put in the position, he was writing a letter to the community of Egypt, which he asked for their support and asked for them to, as we find in other letters, that they asked them to create a connection between their community and the yeshiva. He says, quote, on page 7, the last page, whenever you have transactions with the government, I beg of you to let us know about them so that we may command the help of the prominent members of the community in Baghdad, namely the sons of Rabbi Natira. At this time, Natira was no longer alive. The sons of Rabbi Aaron ben Rabbi Amram, that the government will grant your request according to God's help. If you notice, Rav Sadia, even though he was appointed by David ben Zakkai, he subsequently had a falling out with him. But when he said, how will I help you? Not through the Reish Galusa, not through the exilarch, I'll help you through the Jewish bankers. Because I have influence over them, and they in turn will help you. So again, we see the prominent role of these bankers. Later on, when there was a full-fledged feud between Rav Sadia Gaon and the exilarch, the Reish Galusas, David ben Zakkai, and it became, there were excommunications that were hurled back and forth. Finally, the one who made peace was Cheshad, says Ben Aaron. He quoted the sons of Aaron before in that letter. The father-in-law of Caliph Ben Sarajo, who was a leading scholar, who was an opponent of Rav Sadia Gaon, a supporter of the Reish Galusa. As the author of the Doros HaRishonim, Rav Isaac Halevi, points out, that one could argue that in the feud, which we will discuss in great detail in the subsequent lecture, but because there was a feud between the Rosh Yeshiva, Rav Sadia Gaon, and the Reish Galusa, the exilarch, it could only undermine the position of the exilarch, who, after all was said and done, was the official representative of the Jewish community to the palace of the king. And undermining his position could ultimately undermine the position of Jews in general. But his, this was his, like his Cheshad was the Khalif, this is an Arabic, this is his Arabic translation of his name. The arguments were very bitter, and we have some of the letters which are preserved in the Geniza. But this Cheshad ben Aaron was the father-in-law of this Caliph ben Sarajdo. He wanted peace. And he went and gathered together all the prominent members of the generation to his home, including the Reish Galusa, and told them, how could you allow such a thing to occur? The argument was getting out of hand. When they finally settled amongst themselves, Cheshad was happy and responsible for making peace. They kissed, and they the relations eventually were cordial between the Rosh Yeshiva, Rav Sadia Gaon, and the Reish Galusa. But again, the one who was able to bring peace was one of the prominent Jewish businessmen, Jewish bankers. So again, what I want to point out is now a change, just as basically there have been changes in the Arabic government, and the changes in the source of power of the caliph. There were changes in the power base of the Jews and the Reish Galusa, and we find the Reish Galusa having much less power, and the Jewish bankers just having much more. And we would like to the final citation here of this lecture is in the bottom of page 7, which is a fascinating thing, which is a preserved letter from the vizier. This is the Mishnah Melech, the viceroy, the second of command, Vizier Ali ibn Asa, to the Jewish banker. This is Yosef ben Pinchas. And he starts off, we have in bold, do you want to avoid my inflicting penalties on you that might affect you and your heirs forever? I shall refrain from it on consideration of a matter that will cause you no damage whatever. At the beginning of each month, I need an amount of 30,000 dinars, which must be paid within the first 6 days to the infantry troops. However, I am usually not in possession of such a sum. Either on the first or second day of the month, the soldiers have to be paid. And as we understood from the first half of the lecture, the whole caliph's support was from these troops. The people were up in arms on the caliph. We said there was tremendous dissension amongst the Arabs themselves. the northern Arabs, you know, from the north, the descendants of Yishmael, with the southern Arabs from Yemen. Says there was the Shiites and the Sunnis. There were the original Arabs and the Mawalis, the converts. There were the Syrian Arabs and Iraqi Arabs. There were all kinds of conflicts. These conflicts, by the way, last to this day. Despite calls for Arab unity, says the fissures are so long, you know, and are so well entrenched that if they ever got together, says it could never last for very long. And therefore, they needed a very strong army. And a strong army needs, these people have to be paid. He says, I want you therefore to advance on the first of each month a loan of 150,000 dirhams, an amount that you, as you know, will get back in the course of the month from Ahwa's revenue. He had given him a city or province, Ahwa's. He says, you get all the taxes from this area, so you'll get it back. So, but there's just, we have a cash flow problem here. So I want you to loan it to me, says, and you'll get it back. For the administration of Ahwa's revenue belongs to you, and these monies from Ahwa's are permanent advance of money to you, to which I am going to add a security the amount of 20,000 dinars that are payable each month by Hamid ibn Abbas. There will be compensation for the first installment to be relieved of a heavy burden. So he starts off with an implied warning, and he asks for funds. But a person like that evidently had tremendous influence. If you notice, as we could just turn back here to page 6. On page 5. About the importance, you know, of people of that stature. And beginning on paragraph A on page 5, Rav Shimon ben Lakish said, this thing from Gemara in Chulin, Salik Beis Amud Aleph, this is in 92a, the people of Israel is likened unto a vine. He's describing the vision, the dream. This is the dream that that the Sar HaMashkin, the one who the butler of Pharaoh had in that night in the dungeon. And the Gemara describes it was a dream describing the Jewish people as well. Its branches are the aristocracy. These balabatim. Its clusters, the scholar. Its leaves, the common people. Because afterwards, the leaves are the food source of any plant. Its twigs, this is those in Israel that are void of learning, but they're all still part of the body of the vine. These people have always played an important role. And it seems, as in this juncture of history, they continue to do so. So here, let me just summarize what we've covered in this lecture, and then we'll go read the timeline. Then we will. This is really the end of this year's series. Mirat Hashem will continue next year, and we'll leave it open to questions. We describe the beginnings of the Arab Empire, the death of Muhammad, his successors, the struggle of succession. Because of the struggle of succession, we have two groups, the Shiites, who claim that the rightful successor should be from Ali's family. Ali was the son-in-law, the surviving son-in-law of Muhammad and his descendants. The Sunnites, the majority, who maintain that Muawiyah, who was the Syrian general, the governor of Syria, who was from the Umayyad clan, that he should be the rightful heir. The end was that the majority, of course, followed the Muawiyah. It caused tremendous tension and wars for hundreds and hundreds of years. Finally, the Umayyads were displaced by the Abbasids. One of the Abbasid emperors, Al-Mansur, built Baghdad. Baghdad became not just merely a political capital, became a cosmopolitan center. We described the wares that were brought, the ivory and silk and slaves were brought from all over the world to Baghdad. It became a center of entertainment. It also became a center of decadence. And finally, they lost power. It was basically in the hands of those troops that supported them because of all the dissension within the empire. They needed strong troops. Those who controlled the troops controlled the empire. First, actually, was ironically, was Persians, the Shiites, and eventually in the 900s that had the power. Then the Seljuk Turks, who had the power. Amongst the Jews, we describe that the Reish Galusa moved from the Jewish section of Suras and Pumpadisa, moved to Baghdad, soon, though, lost his power. He had to be propped up by the Rosh Yeshivas. The idea of the income being divided, the lion's share going to the yeshivas minority, to the Reish Galusa, was created during that period of time. So there was a whole change in power, and a new source of power developed, the Jewish bankers, who situated in Baghdad, which was, again, the economic capital, and where were the caliph, the site of the caliph, had inordinate power, even greater than that of the Reish Galusa. I'd like to go over the timeline. Again, we discussed so many names. Again, just worthwhile to go over this again. In 622, Muhammad and his followers flee Medina. This is the Hijra. This is the beginning of the Islam calendar. 632, 10 years later, Muhammad dies and is succeeded by Abu Bakr. 634, 2 years after that, Abu Bakr is succeeded by Umar. Umar reigns for 10 years. Year 644, Umar is succeeded by Uthman. Uthman reigns for 12 years. Uthman is succeeded by Ali, Muhammad's son-in-law. 661, Ali is assassinated. There's a rift amongst Mas regarding succession, and this is the Shiite Ali is the group who are in support of Ali. This is the Shiites. The majority are in support of Muawiyah, who comes to power and founds the dynasty of the Umayyads, who lasted for some 90 years. In 750, the Umayyad dynasty was destroyed by the Abbasids. In 762, the Caliph al-Mansur begins construction of Baghdad, which was completed in 766. It became the new capital of the Islamic Empire. It was not only a political capital, but also the economic capital of the empire. It was the cosmopolitan center. In 825, the Reish Galusa is removed from his official position. And we discussed the Rav Sadia Gaon. Rav Sadia Gaon was appointed in the year 928. By his death in the year of 942, what was left of the family of the Reish Galusa was a young child. However, again, this will be a subject of subsequent lecture. They continue to operate in some minor form, but now the power had gone into the hands of the Jewish bankers. And on that note, we'll conclude this year's series, and we'll open to questions. Yes, Sal. Right. Yeah, we've discussed much of it, and it continues to be discussed next year. You know, that's really, we're just in the middle of this. We had begun in the first lecture of the series. We discussed the yeshivas and the tshuvas and how the yeshivas were conducted. We went through the arguments. In the fifth lecture, we went through various things about poetry, and we'll continue again to discuss the literature of the period. Yes. Yeah, sure. They just had Goyish names, you know, it's like or George or you know. his name, that was his name. Caliph bin thing, that was his name. He was also a Rosh Yeshiva. That was they had like Persian names, evidently. Not always. Some of them were, but not necessarily so. They were not necessarily, the question is, they were Talmid HaChachamim. It's not necessarily, depended. You know, it's like, you know, it's very often you find like Rebbe Sheinikel, you know, those who are the, the dynasty who become the heirs to the dynastic thrones of Hasidic Rebbe. Some of them are Gaonim, or tremendous Gadol, and other ones are not, you know.
We hope you enjoyed this lecture. For more information about this lecture series and to order our audio cassettes and the accompanying outlines, please write to the Jewish Heritage Foundation, 15220 West Lincoln, Oak Park, Michigan, 48237, or call 1-800-797-7729.